Welcome to Taking Care, a Detroit PBS podcast about the many ways we care for one another and what it asks of us in return. I'm your host, Jordan Nightingale. Caregiving has been a part of my life for as long as I can remember, and one day I will share that story, but this episode isn't about me. It's about someone who has helped shape how I understand what care can look like. I have known Mitzi Montague Bauer for more than a decade. We met during a time when caregiving was especially heavy for me, when I was trying to build a life at university while quietly navigating multiple caregiving roles at once. At that time, Mitzi was working on her memoir, and through the process of editing what was a very fresh manuscript, I came to know her as someone who has spent her life caring for others. As a doula, she has supported more than 700 births over a 40-year career. She has also cared for her sister through ALS, a progressive neurodegenerative disease that affects movement and muscle control, as well as her son, Journey, after he was diagnosed with somatic delusional disorder in 2010, which is a mental health condition involving persistent physical symptoms that don't have a clear medical cause. What you are about to hear is a distilled version of a much longer conversation we had that spans birth, death, and everything in between. Because in many ways, Mitzi has dedicated her life to holding space for people during the most vulnerable moments of theirs. And what she has learned challenges many of the assumptions we have about what caregiving is supposed to be. This is Mitzi's story. This episode includes discussion of chronic illness, severe mental health experiences, end-of-life care, and grief. Please take care while listening.
The very first birth I attended, other than my own, was my nephew's. And I was 17 years old. My sister was was pregnant, and her husband was out of town, and she went into labor a little bit early. And so I supported her. And then she went on to tell her friends, oh my gosh, having my sister there really helped me. And then I did it for her friend, and then another person, and just that was just supporting people in that way. And then when I became pregnant, I'd probably done six or seven births before I became pregnant with my daughter, the first pregnancy. And then I hired a doula. And afterwards, it was like, oh my gosh, this is what I've been doing for these women, right? Then I went and got certified in Chicago, did a training back in, I don't know, the early 90s. There's a lot of doula training out there where people are learning the technical part of being a doula. You can't learn how to be a doula in a book or in a class. It comes from just being present at all of those births. I don't know. Can you teach a person compassion and love? I think the best way to teach that is by example, just holding that space for people. It's kind of a calling too. I guess if I could figure out how to teach a doula to be the best that she could be, I would be teaching them. But I don't know how yet, because how do you teach a person compassion or unconditional love or the stillness that's required to serve another person? It's tempting as a doula to bring our own experience, our own agendas to someone else's birth, but it never works that way because that's not our role. Our role is to hold space and to be a loving presence for that person. Yes, to offer comfort measures and, you know, perhaps help them with education along the way, but really the true gift is standing and just holding that space for them, mirroring back to them their own brilliance. And so some people have it and some people don't. it's innate in some people and not so innate in others.
How did you discover that within yourself?
Just by being at birth and being in the presence of so many newborns. Women in labor we're kind of forced to be there. There's this wordless, powerful place within us that we have to go to birth our babies. And just witnessing it over and over and over again, there's nothing else like it. That's why birth transforms us so much, that, you know, you're never the same person after giving birth. And my hope or my goal as a doula is that that's a powerful experience, that it's empowering and not disempowering. I remember once asking my 92-year-old aunt, I was interviewing her, and she was just this host of knowledge. Her fondest memories, her most clear memories at 92 were her births that took place 75 years prior. And I know that the births of our babies, they shape us. They shape how we are as humans and as parents and I think there's nothing more important than just loving the mother through that. What I've discovered is being blessed to have held and witnessed hundreds and hundreds of births and holding those newborn babies, I know without a doubt that we are all born as pure love and that that spark of pure love remains within us throughout our days. That lesson remains with me to this day. Just we're all love at our core. That helps me care for anyone better because I just look for the love. In my doula practice, I tend to avoid the word advocate, even though in the broadest sense of the terms, I am doing that. But when I say that I'm an advocate, it sets up a pretense that there's an us and them. And I like to avoid that. Like if I'm advocating, then there's something that needs to be done, so to speak. I like to look at us as all on the same team, striving for the same goal. That being said, if I see a mother kind of being talked into something, or this is going to happen, the doctor, hey, we think that we should do this now, so we're going to come in and do that without consent, without informed consent, then I will step up and I'll ask on her behalf, like, hey, what about this? Or are there any options? Or I'll ask the mom, do you understand the benefits and risks of this? Like, I want to make sure they have all the information to make an educated decision, but I don't want to make it for them. A good doula doesn't bring her agenda to someone else's birth, and that's something that I'm very cognizant of, that I already had to make all those decisions for myself and my pregnancies, and my job as a doula is to empower the family, and so I would never speak on their behalf or try to influence their decisions, but I do feel that my job is to make sure they have all the relevant information to make an educated decision, and then to stand by it, to make sure that their voice is heard. And probably this took the most time to hone, I guess, but I taught myself to just be really present when I go to a birth. Whatever's happening outside in my world doesn't exist anymore. So I'm just there to be of service and to bring love to an otherwise often fearful place. Just being present it's a gift. Laboring women are very present. You mean they're not thinking about anything, right? Getting through that breath and that next moment. And so when we're that present, I think like yogis go to the mountains and sit in caves for a long time to just try to distill their mind to that very present moment, which labor brings women to all the time, which is why it's so transformative, I think, for us, for women giving birth, and also for those of us witnessing the miracle. I think it's a different in which caregiving situation, but right now, since we're talking about birth, I think the empowerment comes for them by being witnessed and being a part of the process. And women who feel empowered by their births, even if they have an unexpected outcome, I've had women who've had long labors that ended in cesarean births, but they still felt empowered. And they felt empowered because they were a part of the process. They were a part of the decision-making. They know how they got there. And so including them, I mean, it's their births, right? So including them, being included, informing them, and then listening respectfully to their wishes. It's easy for medical professionals or any expert to kind of take that voice away from a person because we feel like we may know better than them. I once had a doctor tell me this woman kind of opted for a cesarean, and the doctor was standing there. She's like, the woman's sitting right there and so is her partner. And the doctor looks at me and she's like, tell her she doesn't need one. And I'm like, that's not my job at all. You know, I'm not going to tell her she doesn't need one. My job is to make sure she has all the current information, the relevant information to make a decision and then to support her decision. So I was surprised that the doctor's like, tell her what to do. Like, no. And that's empowering for a woman to be heard and to be honored and then to go through that awesome experience of bringing new life into the world. In the end, when a woman has had an unexpected outcome, if she knows that she did everything she could to achieve her goal and that she was supported in that way, then she can heal from that. She's not haunted by what if. But if a woman is rushed into something or another agenda is placed before her own, then she's always going to wonder, gosh, what if I had done this? Or what if we had given it more time? Or and it kind of haunts people. So I just do my best to make sure a person's voice is heard. Currently, I'm helping just a friend I met who has no family, and so I kind of adopted him. He's medically compromised, but his mind is sharp. But when he's speaking, it doesn't seem that way. because it takes him a long time to formulate his answers. But, and so then people just want to rush him through it or speak for him or over him. And just notice how important it is to just take a breath and listen and not finish his sentences for him. Just support him and encourage him, you know, that he does have the answers and that we'll patiently wait for them. It goes back to the person we're caring for and not trying to change the course or fix them, you know, just serve them to the best of our ability. It's a lot easier to care for someone who, even though a laboring mother's in pain, she's not suffering, ideally. But caring for someone who is suffering, who is in a lot of pain, that isn't in labor, having a baby where it's finite, where there's, you know, purpose behind it and there's joy at the end, like that's hard. And I have a lot of compassion for people who do that day in and day out, where they care for a loved one who's chronically ill. And I did do that with my sister who had ALS. We had a lot of conversations while her body was decomposing. Her mind was always sharp. And so we had plenty of conversations about what that would look like and as her life drew to an end, what she wanted. And I felt confident with fulfilling that role for her. It wasn't easy, but I understood what she was asking of me. Yeah, it's not pleasant, but also it's human. You know, it's a part of our humanity to take care of each other. I was my sister's durable power of attorney. And at that point, my other sister had just died. My sister Dawn had died of a brain aneurysm. And then just a few months later, my other sister Lana was diagnosed with ALS. And so my mom and I, and, you know, some hired help to care of her. It's a lot different because, well, first of all, she told us, you know, when it gets to this point in my illness, then I don't want any heroic measures or I want to go to hospice to die. And so the very first thing she said was when I can't eat anymore. Well, that happened just a few months into her diagnosis. And so then she opted to have a feeding tube placed. And so even as her durable power attorney, I'm like, okay, wait a minute. That was the thing I was supposed to uphold, right? I'm supposed to like honor her wishes and make sure that they're heard. So it changed a lot. In the end, when we took her to hospice, you know, I'm like, okay, she doesn't want any food or water. She just wants to be comfortable. And then they're like, yep, we're reading it right here. What I didn't know at the time, but I do know now, because also was with one of my best friends when she passed recently, is that sedating is a euphemism for you won't see this person anymore. Like when a person's dying. So they're like, okay, we're going to keep her comfortable. We're going to sedate her and keep her comfortable. Naively, I thought I would go in the next morning and talk to her. But when I went in the next morning, the feeding tube was gone. There's no IV fluids. And she was conscious from morphine. And I didn't realize that I'd had the last final conversation with her when I took her to hospice. I was so sad. I kind of ranted at God a little bit, like, gosh, I thought I would at least see her eyes one more time, you know? And when I was holding her as she was getting ready to pass, I was singing to her, just told her, like, there's so much love, just, you know, build a bridge and go home. And at her final breath, she opened her eyes, or God opened her eyes. I mean, I know she was like snowed on morphine. So I know that she personally could not have opened her eyes, but her eyes opened and I was, you know, 6 inches from her face. And I was just in awe because whatever she was seeing, whatever her eyes were beholding was beautiful. And then it was just for a breath or two. And it was almost like her soul left through her eyes, you know, and she then closed her eyes. And that was that. But I got my prayer, right? I got to see her eyes one more time. And so it was beautiful. I was left with just profound sense of peace, not angst. Honestly, death and birth, for those of us who have attended both, it almost feels like the same door, like a spiritual opening where souls come forth and then the same door opens and souls go home. But energetically, spiritually, it feels quite similar. It's an honor. It's definitely an honor to be present for that. There's some profound presence that escorts us here and that takes us home. That when we're there, if we're quiet and still, we have a glimpse of it as ourselves. You can't be the same. I mean, witnessing the miracle either way, coming or going, is it just changes you on us. Just the very fabric of who I am is different. I was caring for my sister during the time that my son was symptomatic. I was kind of going back and forth between the two, very different situations, actually, obviously. With my son, who was experiencing challenges with navigating his mental health, sometimes clear as a bell, and other times, not. And so I found myself often enabling him, which would be, for me, the definition of enabling a person is doing something for them that they could do for themselves so that I didn't have to feel my own pain around that. And so it was hard. It was like, well, would I do this for a healthy 24-year-old? No. But then in my mind, I'd be like, what? Is he healthy? And at times he was willing and open to have my help, and at other times, not at all. And when the person you're trying to support is an adult, then you have limited access to their care anyway, depending on how much they're willing to, you know, allow you to be in their lives. Yeah, it was hard. I was primarily in the role of mother at that point, fierce mama bear. Journey was saying that he was attacked on campus, you know, just a random thing, a gang of men he didn't know, coming home from a party, was by himself. And after that, we just started seeing a behavior that I didn't really recognize. He kept insisting that there was something wrong with his colon, like, and he would tell you, right, you know, the exact place. And at that point, the rest of his conversations were very cogent and clear. It was just this one area where he's saying, look, there's something wrong here, and nobody's paying attention. And so we would go to the doctor and they would want to give him, you know, an over-the-counter something for digestive aid or whatever. And so finally, I just, you know, begged his family practice doctor, like, please just order these scans. And so we paid for them. We ordered MRIs and barium enemas and the whole, just looked from top to bottom, and there was nothing medically amiss, but he kept insisting that there was something we were missing. And so while he was perseverating on the fact that he was dying, we were told this is a mental illness. And, you know, he was just saying, no, it's not in my head. I'm sick. And so it was really hard to navigate. Yeah, it was painful. It was painful because he just didn't, you know, he's like, maybe if I were a different person or had more money, then doctors would be paying attention. They'd be looking harder for what's really wrong. And, you know, much later, interestingly, 10 years later, now, if you look at some of the studies coming out about mental illness, there's a lot of connection to the gut. A lot of, I don't know what, 95% of the receptor sites for serotonin are in the gut. And so now I look back at them like, well, maybe there was a connection, but, you know, hindsight. It was a painful time, like, just to see someone you love. And he was brilliant. He was in university on scholarship and was used to being the smartest person in the room. And so when he was told, like, you know, that his brain was broken, it was like a hardwire problem. And yeah, it was a challenging time. And Journey was always was very kind of insightful, had a prescience about him that he always was very tuned into me. And so if I was fearful or I had an agenda, no matter what I said, how I presented myself, he knew it. You know, if I was coming from clarity, he would sit and listen. But most of the time I had an agenda. I felt like I knew what he needed more than he did. I wanted something for him. I was inside. I was afraid. And he was just like, talk to the hand. Wherever we can give the person who's experiencing the mental health challenges, wherever we can give them autonomy, it's a helpful time to do so. And like I said, if finding resources, like, some people's mental health challenges may be a spiritual experience. Others may be dietary, or they've got, you know, they're deficient in something. I mean, everyone's a different. Seeking to support that. And I would always say, like, there are our functional psychiatrists. There's, if you go to Journey's Dream website, there's several of them we've interviewed on the podcast who are dedicated to finding the root cause of what is causing this imbalance, rather than just saying, we don't know. Telling a person that, like, look, there's an imbalance, sure, but we can, let's figure out what it is and address it. That would be a hopeful message, rather than, you know, you're not going to get better. And it wasn't until after Journey died when I realized that I had stumbled upon some resources, some, like, the right thing in the search engine, and found actually a couple of psychiatrists who considered themselves functional doctors. And functional doctor and integrative doctor is more interested in, like, discovering the root cause of an illness and addressing that, rather than just masking it with symptoms, which is what was happening with Journey. They were just using medication to alter his symptoms so he'd be more pleasant to be around. But not for himself. He couldn't put a thought together. I wish I had lots of do-overs when it comes to that. But I did the best I could in the moment. Every action I took came from a loving place, but also from fear. And those two are opposing forces. So I wish I could have been more loving and present and maybe more detached, but I wasn't able to be. I was his mom.
I'm going to pause here to focus on something Mitzi's experience highlights, and that's the importance of having trained healthcare professionals who can provide support, especially when families need it most. Whether care is planned or unexpected, it asks a lot of the people giving it, and it depends on a workforce that is prepared to meet those needs with skill and compassion. Support for Taking Care comes from Impart Alliance at Michigan State University, who is working to strengthen Michigan's direct care workforce through research, training, and statewide collaboration, building the systems that prepare, support, and sustain the people who provide essential care every day. To learn more, visit impartalliance.msu.edu.
I wish I could have said to my son, I'm here to support you. These are the things I think would be helpful based on the research I've done, but let me know what you need. Let me know how I can help. And that would have given him a tiny bit of his autonomy back and his own dignity. He was a proud person. He was, you know, really smart, high IQ, funny, musical. That doesn't go away when a person receives a diagnosis. That brilliant person is still there. And so meeting them there, you know, psychiatrists, they have 5-10 minutes with a person. They're overloaded with people. But in my opinion, once they're stable, be it through medication or what have you, once a person's head's above water, that's when the real work begins. Like, okay, what happened to initiate this divided thinking in the first place? But that's not how it goes. I mean, I think most doctors feel like once they've educated a patient about their disease and it's not hopeful, you know, it's like, well, sorry, kid, this tough luck for you. We don't know we don't know why this happens, and there's not a cure. You're just going to have to take medicine for the rest of your life and, you know, hope for the best. That's a hopeless answer. You know, I remember leaving the hospital visiting journey once my daughter and I went to see him, and it was wintertime and we were stomping snow off our boots, and his face lit up. He always loved the snow. He's like, oh, is it snowing outside? And, you know, how much snow is out there? And he didn't even know if it was dark outside because he had to look at the clock to see that. And what I realized was there wasn't a window anywhere. He'd been there 2 weeks. There was nowhere to glimpse even outside. And so inmates in prison at least get to go outside or see outside. I just wondered, like, how can a person be well when they're, you know, locked inside and under fluorescent lighting and eating subpar food and told that they won't get well? Like, how can they? You know, so I think we have a long way to go in caring for this vulnerable population. And I think it starts with the message we give them right from the beginning. I did a bad job taking care of myself during that time. In part, as I mentioned, my sister Dawn died in May. That same month, Journey came home from university, and it became obvious to us then that his situation was more severe than we had anticipated with him being away at school. Then in June, Brea got married, and then in August, Josh got married, and then in September, my sister was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's. In September also, Journey was hospitalized for the first time. I just was like not taking care of myself. I didn't feel, I mean, like I could barely process what was happening. It's a miracle that I didn't fall over like from whatever, but at one point, I think after both of my sisters died and I was still taking care of my friend and my son, I had this dream, and it was one of those vivid dreams, the kind that like leave an impact on you in the morning, not just the random things, but like something happened, right? I was in an old stone church, like a really old church, felt like, you know, it was ancient. And I was sitting there by myself. There's the beautiful stained glass that I was looking at. And then somewhere a voice within the church felt like me, felt like divinity. I don't know. Something's like, just scoot over a little bit more so you can get this color here. And this color is on. And so I'm laying in that beautiful light. I'm like, the stained glass is healing. It's not just for beauty. And while I was laying there, it was so clear to me, this voice without a body basically said, if you don't start taking care of yourself, you're going to be the next one that everybody's worried about. In due time, you won't be worrying about these things that you're worrying about and these people that you're worrying about. So you need to take care of yourself. And then I woke up, and it was very apparent, like, oh, you need to just take care of myself. But what I took away from that was the part that said, in due time, you won't be worrying about these people anymore. How I interpreted that as a desperate mother wanting her son to be better was, oh, Journey's going to get well. That must mean he's going to get better, right? So I'm not going to have to worry about him anymore. But essentially what that meant was all those people that I was caring for and worried about were not in a physical body anymore. And so therefore I did not have them to care for. But even hearing that very clear message, I didn't take care of myself very well. I just barely had time to, I mean, I did my best. Like I would go for a walk or I would go to yoga, but my mind was just not there. You know, I tell people that now who ask, like, who are taking care of, you know, their children or people who are not well or, take care of yourself. But I feel like a hypocrite because I didn't take care of myself very well. I mean, I knew I should. I just couldn't put it in. I didn't do very well at it. So there was a point in time when Journey, after he graduated from university and he was back home with us, he'd been hospitalized 3 times in quick succession, not for his gut, but for his mental health. He was home and I spent all my waking time with him. Like I would go to the birth center and work. And then as soon as I got home, I would come in and we would talk or visit or watch TV together or we would read to each other or whatever we were doing. And then I would literally spend all my time with him. And he would encourage me to go out with my friends or go outside or go on a date with my husband, like, Mom, go do some things. And I didn't want to. I wanted to be with him. And so one day I came home and I spoke to him and he just looked through me and ignored me and walked away. And I was livid at the time, like, what's wrong with you? But he carried that on for 3 months, all summer. He just ignored me. And so after a week or two, I would try knocking his door, Journey, what's going on? Have I offended you? Like, let's talk about this. Nothing. 3 months later, I came home from work one day and he was, hey, Mom, how's it going? Like nothing had happened. And finally, what he said to me was, I said, Journey, what would possess you to do that? That was horrible. Why would you just ignore me for 3 months? Like, what have I done to you for that? He said, well, remember when I was encouraging you to go out with your friends and have a date with Dad or go to yoga class? I'm like, yeah, what does that have to do with this? He's like, well, you did it. It worked. He was right. It seemed like he was being selfish and mentally ill, but really what he was doing was choosing to offer me a gift of, some normalcy in my life. And after that, I did my best to like, okay, here's the point. I do feel better. I do feel like I'm more sane now that I've, stepped outside of this kind of mad world and, done some things for myself. So it was a good lesson, but I didn't learn it on my own. In truth, I'm still learning those things. I had an accident 5 days ago and fell on my back and was completely unable to care for myself. I got to be in the role of needing care. I got to find out it's a lot easier for me. And I think this is probably true for many people, but it's a lot easier for me to offer support than receive it. It was very challenging for me to just be in that vulnerable place of needing help. So I'm still learning that. But the trust element, I think a caregiver at their best shows up every day or every moment. For me, I am a spiritual person. I believe that there's a higher intelligence. And so I seek that whenever possible to guide me to when I don't trust, when I am afraid in that situation, I just do my best to turn it over. And it's harder to care and trust, I think, for someone that we have a deep bond of affection for than we get entangled more. I mean, I'll speak for myself. I get entangled more. It was harder for me to step away from fear, to step away from my own angst and be a clear, present person when I was emotionally distraught by the person I was caring for. Birth is different. I mean, that's different, but I've also cared for people, my sister, my son, dear friends who were ill and at the end of their lives. And I guess I haven't got there yet. I'm still learning about trust. Truthfully, I did feel alone. I was surrounded by loving friends and loving people, but it just felt like a really lonely thing I had to do. No one else was, none of my friends, although they were loving me, supporting me, bringing meals when Journey was alive, I just felt like it was my mission to figure out a way to save him. That was my complete and utter daily round was spent on that. And so, yeah, it would have been much easier if I could have just said, okay, God, it's in your hands. I'm here to be a servant. Guide me as you see fit. And really mean that. I mean, I probably uttered those words, but to actually just sit in the truth of that would have been wonderful, but I just didn't. And so I did feel alone. I felt like it was work that I needed to do. And then when I became a mom, I prayed every day that God would put my children's feet on the path he chose for them, place their feet on the path, protect them, help me help them. And then to see my son at his worst, I was like, what could this possibly be? How could this be your chosen path for my son? I had a lot of questions and a lot of doubt and a lot of anger and fear, but the process that on my own in the car or outside, and then I would, even though I was angry at God and sometimes would just renounce God, then in the next breath, I'd be like, okay, God, help me be present for my sister. So And then, okay, I need some help here. You know, so I would always do my best to just be present in the moment and not offer platitudes or pretenses. I've always felt that God and love were synonymous. And so when I couldn't address God as God, I would do my best to just think of it in the form of love. And sometimes that was easier to just see, okay, what's being called to me right now? Well, I'm being called to be a loving presence. And so I can do that. And for anybody, for my son and my sister, you know, I would just ask the questions like, are you afraid of dying? Or is there anything you feel like you need to say to anybody? Or how can I serve you in getting communication to people if you need it? Or like, I was set on just, how can I support you so that when you get to the end, you're ready to go? And it was quite selfless. I think being a doula taught me this, just to put my own needs and my own thoughts and my own agendas, leave them outside the door, and then come and be present for that person, whatever way I can be. And then when I walked out the door, then there it was all for me again. And that's the hard part for caretakers. Then what do you do when you then pick up your heavy burden on the way out the door? You know, what do you do with it? And who do you go to for help? And how do you ground that or not just become a mess from? And I think that's as a caretaker, that's the delicate balance of, it was relatively easy for me to be present for the people I loved in the moment. But when I walked out the door, then it became a challenge of sometimes I just get in my car and sob. It was lonely, actually, to feel like that I'd been abandoned, but you know, or that I had abandoned this spiritual part of myself that was so woven into my life. And then when I just denied it or didn't access that anymore, or, you know, whatever, I felt really lonely. Like, yeah, it was a lot. It was a hard period of time. There were several, but also I learned that I just couldn't change the course of Journey's life. Like, as much as I wanted to, as much as I tried, like, God, if love or if persistence could have saved a person, he'd still be here today. But it just became clear, like, it wasn't my course to change. But that didn't happen. That clarity didn't come until much later. But what I did see were lots of little miracles, prayers being answered all the time, but they weren't the one I wanted. So it was easy to be just like, nope, you know. But I remember just like asking for something in my heart without even saying it out loud. And within 2 or 3 minutes, like, here, this thing you just asked for, or a moment of relief or an answer or whatever. It was just like countless prayers were answered, little ones all the time for my comfort, but I didn't acknowledge them or recognize them because I was too lost in my son's perceived suffering. And once Journey died, though I was surrounded by people who, you know, for months, people brought me food and cared for me. And I literally felt lifted by prayer. I felt like my feet weren't touching the ground. I felt so cared for, but also so broken apart. I was surrounded by people, but I still felt like the work I had to do as a grieving mother was just mine to do. Nobody could do it for me. It just couldn't. I had to do it myself. There was a lot of grace following his death, but the pain was so acute that it was hard to see it at the time. But in retrospect, I can see that prayers were being answered all the time, and that care was so profound, and that God's love was so present. But it didn't feel that way because my son wasn't there. So there was a point in time where I was laying on the couch and just caught myself thinking, like, well, I think at the time I was 52 or something, like 50 or something. Like, you know, I've lived most of my life at this point. And I was kind of like counting the days, really, or like, okay, so just when will I see him again, kind of thing. And so it was me laying there thinking, at that point, both of my sisters had died. My niece had died. My son had died. Good friend had died. And my business was, I was a part owner of a business, and it got closed down. So it was a lot of like loss and a lot of like empty time, like free time now. Of all the things I was doing before, I'm like, all of a sudden there was like, wait a minute, what am I supposed to be doing now? And I had to really decide in that moment, like I was at a fork in the road. I knew no one would blame me if I just curled up and didn't do another thing. Surely I would get a pass, you know? I wrote about this in my book. I had these two dreams that were even more profound to me. It lifted me up out of a deep, deep hole. And because I didn't know what was true anymore, right? And so I was so distraught and so, so overcome with just fear and hopelessness. And one night while I was going to bed, I just asked God, I'm like, please just send me a dream of something that's true. Please, just anything that's true that I can hold on to that I know is true from you. That night I had two dreams. And the first dream was Journey was an infant, about, I don't know, 7 or 8 months old, and I was nursing him. And the sun was shining on his face, like this ray of light was shining on his face. And I would kind of had my hand like protecting him from the brightness of it. And I was just looking down at him with just such adoration that my heart was just so full of love. That dream reinforced for me, like somehow I felt like maybe as a mother, I'd messed him up, right? Like you can read books about mental illness with kids, like that maybe they were, you know, and usually it's the mother who messes them up, right? And so I'd been reading these books about maybe I did something that I, you know, but the dream was reflected back to me that I loved him. I cherished him more than life, and that there was, I didn't do anything wrong, basically is what it told me. And then as soon as that dream ended, the second dream was, I wasn't in the dream, but I was witnessing. I was like a witness to the dream. And I saw this person with a whole host of beings without bodies, like these light beings, and they were discussing her life on Earth. And I understood that there was a plan, that she had a plan. And then when she was born, she was living out her plan. And then I was also witnessing the mother who was sobbing and praying constantly at her side, like, God, please heal her. Why aren't you healing her? It was a physical illness for her, but it was like, please, God, please, God, please, God. What? Why have you forsaken my daughter? When in actuality, what I could see as the witness was like, she is doing what she came to do. When I woke up, I sat with that for a good long time, and I knew that it was directly given to me as a gift from source, that I was, one, that I didn't mess up my kid, and two, that there was a bigger picture that I couldn't see from my limited view. For me, and this was a challenging lesson to learn, was that despite how much I loved my son, it was not my course. And that no matter how hard I tried to steer it a different way or have a different outcome or have him make different choices for himself, because it just looked like the choices he was making were devastating. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't. And I personalized that. Like I would make that my mission, and it wasn't. And I didn't learn that until many years after he died, that this was his soul's choice, he and God, and that I was the witness to it. I was, you know, I could be a loving presence, but I couldn't change it. And it's still hard for me to believe that that would be a course that someone would choose, but I have to trust that it is. I also knew in that moment, like if I was going to live, then I was going to live. I wasn't going to be defined by this grief and sorrow. And so Journey, really, in that moment, even though he'd been, you know, had made his transition a couple of years ago, from that point, I felt very strongly from him, like, Mom, you have a life to live. Off the couch and take a breath and take a step. And so in that moment, I'm like, okay. But I also knew then that I had to dig in and just keep doing the hard work. The writing came first before the nonprofit. And at first it was just an act of survival for me. It was just a way to heal in part. And I didn't know this until I had written it all down, that I was carrying so many details in my head. There were 9 hospitalizations in the 4 years of Journey's symptomology, and 9 different hospitalizations, lots of different medications, lots of different experiences and treatment centers. And I had all of that logged in my head. Once I wrote it down and then it was like safely somewhere else, I didn't have to carry it around. And so that was the ultimate gift of the writing the book, was for myself. It's like, okay, here this is now. I don't have to, you know, hold on to it in that capacity any longer. And then at some point, a person I know, a professor at MSU, was an English professor, and she was looking for like a freelance job outside of the campus. And so I asked her to read what I had written and wondered, well, one, am I a good enough writer for someone else to read this? And secondly, is this a compelling enough story? And she came back right away and said yes to both of those things, and that it was an important message for people to hear. So I just set about time every day, I set aside time. My doula practice came to a halt, basically, and I'd never had a month where I wasn't on call. And suddenly I didn't have any clients. I had 4 months of just time. So I spent it obviously grieving, but a few hours a day I wrote. My hope was that because I never stopped looking for answers. And by the time toward the end of Journey's life, I felt like I had met perhaps some doctors or some therapies or something that might be useful. So a doctor in Chicago who I felt like understood perhaps more of the root cause of what Journey might have been experiencing, or was willing to explore the root causes and get to the root of it. And he felt like he could help Journey. But at that point, Journey had been told so many times that he was broken and that, you know, his autonomy was usurped over and over again. And so he didn't really want to listen to anyone else. When he died, I felt like, well, now I have these resources that might have helped. And what would have happened if I'd had him in the beginning when he was open and asking for help? And so I wanted to provide a space or a place for people to have the answers that I didn't have when I needed them. And so that was the inspiration for Journey's Dream, a nonprofit organization to highlight solutions. We all know about the medication and talk therapy, but many people don't know about many of the other options that are available. And so that was the impetus for our nonprofit. You know, and additionally to highlighting these solutions or these doctors or treatments, most people who need them don't have the resources to access them, because insurance doesn't cover a lot of those things. And so being a nonprofit is my dream that we can support those people financially as well. So shine a light. I just feel like if Journey were offered at any point in time, like, hey, look, here's a list of 10 possibilities that may help you find balance. Pick a couple that work for you and we'll go down those roads. That would have given him some of his own self-governance back, and he could have chosen. And then I think if he had chosen him himself, he would have stuck to that. But being forced to go a course that he wasn't on board with and that he felt terrible doing, he just kept coming off the medication and not responsibly. And that wrecks havoc on a brain. I just often wish, like, gosh, if I'd have had a list of here's a menu, like here's some possibilities, what resonates with you? I think that would have been a much more successful approach than essentially, you know, a couple of times the hospital staff held him down and injected him with the medicine. We all desire and deserve our dignity, regardless of how we physically present. That was the whole thing with you know, Journey's Dream. Like sometimes I look at myself and I'm like, why did I write a book about this that then invites people to reach out to me about their own grief? Or why am I in a mental health nonprofit that I'm constantly immersed in it? I can't remove myself from it, you know? But the answer is just that. Like, well, I hope this one interview, if it touches one person and they take a step or something else, then it's worth it. And it was the same with the book and the same with the nonprofit. It's just, well, because we're a community. And if we can learn from each other and lift each other up, then that's what we're here to do. Then I hope it does. I hope that there's a something that somebody hears that supports them.
Moments like that are what build a caregiving community. They remind us of how important it is to feel supported and not alone. Hi, it's me again. I want to take a brief pause to talk about the caregiving initiative at Detroit PBS. It is made possible by listeners like you. During Public Media Giving Days on May 1st and 2nd, your support can go even further. With a gift of just $6 a month, you help create more spaces where caregivers can feel seen, heard, and less alone in the shared human experience. You also support powerful caregiving content. This includes conversations with local caregivers and organizations on One Detroit and American Black Journal, along with community events and national programming like Caregiving, the documentary with executive producer Bradley Cooper. To learn more or make a gift, visit DetroitPBS.org/donate. Now let's return to Mitzi's story.
I had a client once, beautiful human being, and the father said to me, he was from Africa, and he said to me, you can tell a lot about a society based on how they treat their most vulnerable. And where he lived, they didn't have daycares in his village, nor were there nursing homes or assisted living. They all just lived together and took care of each other. And that, those are cultures where I think the caregiving is just interwoven with life, right? It's not separated out. But yeah, we do live in silos, and I don't know that it's ideal. I think new moms are often lonely and isolated, you know, without meaningful, I mean, obviously being a new mom is very meaningful, but meaningful adult conversations, let's put it that way. Yeah, I think there's just moments where we're better together. I feel like I finally stopped scrambling when I was able to direct a modicum of the care I was providing outside of myself to myself. And it took a lot of practice. For me, it started with just sitting in silence for 5 minutes. I wouldn't call it praying. I wouldn't call it meditating. I didn't require my mind to do anything, but I didn't allow myself to get up and I didn't allow myself to have distractions with phones or whatever. I would just sit in the silence for 5 minutes. As I did that, I started to feel more compassion for myself, and my daily round changed. As if I would just start my day with a few minutes of silence, a few connected breaths, it became easier to navigate the outer world when I was tending just a few moments to my inner world. And some people, it may be prayer. I mean, sometimes for me, it was prayer, but I just took all the pressure off of just sit here, just sit out in silence for a few minutes. Slowly, I feel like the love that I extended outward began to be more accessible to me. You know, it's hard to give somebody anything when your cup is empty. So we have to fill our cups in whatever ways we can. And so I would think, and I know I feel a little bit like a hypocrite saying it, because when I was in the trenches with my son, I wasn't doing it, but even though I knew I should, but I would just encourage people to find time for themselves, time that fills their cup and that doesn't have anything to do with caregiving. It just has to do with appreciation for what's around them. Caregiving now looks a lot, it's a lot freer and a lot more enjoyable. I have semi-retired from my doula practice. I take fewer clients, so I have more free time, and I live on the same property as two of my grandchildren. So it feels really good to just be at this point in life where, despite a lot of chaos in the world, my orbit feels really peaceful. You know, my little space. I just recently took, my husband had surgery a couple of weeks ago. And so I was kind of in that role again of just, you know, waiting on a person hand and foot. And he's allergic to every pain medication practically. So he's like coming off surgery on aspirin, and it was hard. And it was just a reminder of like, dang, yes, it's hard for him to be in so much pain, but it's really hard for a person to witness another person's pain, you know, for any long period of time. So I just recognized that. I'm like, okay, but this is temporary. This is just his surgery. He's recovering. But I spend quite a bit of time with my grandchildren, my granddaughters, and that doesn't feel like caregiving at all. That just feels like living, like joyful living, really. It's sometimes hard to separate. Well, is this caregiving, or is this just, you know, going for a walk with my grandkids, or is this caregiving, or is this just soothing a friend? I mean, I think it's interwoven. I don't think I mean, at least in my life, I can't separate it out. It's interesting because caregiving a lot of times just feels like a natural part of my life as a doula, as a mother, as a grandmother, as friend, my sister. It's hard for me even kind of to separate it out. Yeah, I think it's just an ongoing process. There isn't an end. And it is just a natural extension of living, I think, to just care for others. On Monday afternoons, I teach homeschool children. There's a homeschool collective that my daughter and friend created. And so there's like six or seven families. So I teach the children handwork, knitting and crocheting and dyeing and needle felting and sewing, hand sewing. And so that's just joyful. Like, I just get together with a bunch of children and we all create beautiful art, and I grow vegetables. I mean, it's like a 180 from where I was 15 years ago when I was caring for so many people sorrowfully, you know. Now it's just, if I care for people, it's happy.
Each caregiving experience is isolating in its own way. The needs are different. The timing is different. Even the versions of the people we love and who we are with them are always changing. It can be difficult to build and rebuild a life and a sense of community through all of that. It asks of us to keep adjusting to meet those needs while still trying to hold on to some versions of ourselves. But maybe we're not meant to hold on to it in the same way. Like Mitzi said, caregiving is change in action. That may be why it is so difficult to endure, to make sense of, and to live through. What stays with me from this conversation is not just what Mitzi has been through, but how she understands caregiving itself. She doesn't see it as fixing or controlling outcomes. She sees it as presence. She sees it as listening. She sees it as making space for someone else's experience, even when it is painful or uncertain. That kind of care is powerful, even as it's isolating. That's why this caring community exists. If this conversation resonated with you, you are not alone. You can find more stories, resources, and ways to connect at detroitpbs.org/caregiving. You can also follow Detroit PBS on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube to continue the conversation. This work is part of Detroit PBS's Stationwide Caregiving Initiative in partnership with Impart Alliance at Michigan State University, with additional support from the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, the Ralph C. Wilson Jr. Foundation, the Michigan Health Endowment Fund, and the AARP of Michigan. If you would like to learn more about Mitzi's work, her memoir, Journey, A Mother's Account of Love, Loss, and Spiritual Healing, is available now on Amazon. You can also connect with her nonprofit, Journey's Dream, at journeysdream.org. Thank you for listening. This is Taking Care.